a stone wall, wow, wow. There's a rubber wall where a man sees things and hears sounds that's not there. He's headed for the rubber wall. Illusions in a twisted line to save from self-destruction. It's the rubber room where a man can't run into the wall till strength makes him fall and lie still and cry for help. Here's the rubber room.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Adam Parfrey. He is the publisher of Feral House Books. Adam, it's great talking to you.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I'm also joined here with Pilleater and J.G. Michaels.
Hi, Adam.
What's up?
Hi there. Hey.
Adam, can you talk about how you started, originally started Feral House Books? What inspired you to start Feral House, and what was your background in publishing before that?
All right, take us back to New York in the late 80s. At that point, I had worked at the Strand Bookstore at 12th and Broadway. You might know that big, huge bookstore up there. And I was doing tasks that all the ordinary minimum wage slaves did at that point. And during my time there, I was in the literature section of the Strand. I went to a guy named George Petros, who worked in the science section of Strand Bookstore. And George had an idea of publishing his serial art or graphic art or comic book type stuff that he was drawing. And I suggested to him to make it more interesting that you include, just do a solo type of operation, but include a lot of other people's works. So we did that. We did a magazine together, Exit. And in that magazine, there are people involved from the original Zap comics, like Robert Williams and S. Clay Wilson. And that magazine had kind of a satirical point of view of remakes of historical ideas of a totalitarian nature. After that, I met some guy and I spoke to him. He ran a store in Los Angeles where he did stats and halftones. That was a way images were reproduced back at that time for advertisements and other reasons and books at the time. You didn't have Photoshop or anything like that. So this fellow, his name was Ken Sweezy, we talked about putting a publishing house together, and it was called Amok Press. Amok, A-M-O-K. And his brother was doing this Amok catalog, in which people would order strange and offbeat literature, and he would, he was sort of like the middleman between the publishers and the buyers. And so the Amok catalog was interesting. I contributed to that. And then as far as Amok Press goes, we did works that were not usually published in the industry itself. I had a lot of interest in the time of the old, Depression era railroad people. And we did a book called You Can't Win and Boxcar Bertha among that time period stuff. And then other books, I had done. One was called Rants and Incendiary Tracks, and that book was regarding the most inflammatory, bizarre literature that you would call rant, so it would not be that, it would be explicit, but not lengthy material. And that did well for us. And so there was a situation between this that my partner Ken and his brother Stuart, and there was a fraternal problem they had, and it became such a problem. I had to start my own house rather than being in the middle of a fight all the time with these guys. So that's when Feral House began. I think initially in 1989, I had moved from New York to Los Angeles at that point. And so I started a publishing company in Los Angeles. There was not much in that way in LA at that time as far as publishing goes. But we did that. That's when Feral House began.
Was there sort of an overall theme, just kind of covering ideas that are taboo? There's the themes of a shock value, covering a lot of avant-garde artists. If you had to say what the original theme was in the beginning, what were you going after?
Well, I don't really care for this idea that it was about shock and shocking books solely. I had a broader interest, and I just went along things that made me curious as a reader and explored that. The book that everybody discusses about the early days is a book called Apocalypse Culture. And people were not expecting the material that was in that book. Some of it was shocking, some of it was not, but it was an exploratorium of odd ideas in the world at this point. And we were getting to the year 2000, and at that point I was thinking this was a millennial idea or apocalyptic idea to reach at that time and pace. And so that's was behind that book. There were a lot of other books that were publishing that, you know, as I said, about the Depression era world of people were outside the corporate capitalist system, and they were, you know, train runners and other things. So that, you know, that idea fascinated me. The other things that fascinated me, I think the first book I had published at Feral House, because I met the man who started Church of Satan, Anton LaVey, and it was interesting because, you know, he was a fascinating guy, and he had interest in things that were pertained to my own background, because I came from a family of movie people and theatrical people. My father being a character actor, and so we both had interest in that world, and so I decided to republish a book that had been out of print for decades called The Satanic Witch, or was called The Complete Witch, but then I renamed it The Satanic Witch to be more true to the reality of the book itself.
You also write a lot about occultism, but what's interesting about your work, I've listened to the interview you did about occultism. You analyze it in an academic standpoint rather than the sort of a sensational standpoint that you might get from Alex Jones, and that's I find that really interesting.
Yeah, thanks. It's you don't want to do stuff that's just kind of crap and nonsense. You want to get to the reality of the situation, and it just playing up the sensationalism of it just for the sake of selling the idea better is not an idea, is, does not strike me as a good a way to go about the world that it exists in.
With the books with the Feral House, I noticed they have a very unique, distinct aesthetic design to them. Is there one artist who's done a number of books? And have you intentionally gone out of your way to create this unique design and aesthetic look?
Well, I'm glad you appreciate the design, but it's not a unique design because we have many, many designers among, you know, the people who design the books or the layout of the book or the design of the book. So the there is a guy named Sean Tetrarachi, who's really extraordinary designer, and his work you may be thinking of as one of them. But we have, you know, four or five different designers for our books, and they're all pretty good. So I had a situation because I worked in this small publishing house in New York after I worked at the Strand Bookstore. It was called Performing Arts Journal Publications. They did theater books. But I, it was interesting because I was laying out or designing the books myself. And so I got involved with that aspect of publishing. So I had an awareness of it. It's sort of like, it's a bit more wide-ranging for a publisher to actually do the design himself, to know about the way and the apparatus of design. That could have helped in that regard.
Do you have personally a favorite artistic and aesthetic style? Are you a fan of a mid-century modern? I see that style with a lot of them. I think there was a book published on mid-century space age architecture in L.A.
Well, I appreciate that. Are you talking about like the Googie type coffee shops and kind of thing?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, sure, of course, but and a lot of it also came from, in terms of my working with that older mode of design, was in, you know, working at the Strand Bookstore, and then working on that Exit magazine, because there were a lot of instructional books that had a certain design, ran into that mid-century mode, and even pre-mid-century mode design for instructional books. And, you know, so there was a lot of illustrative value as well as textual value. And I like both aspects of not ignoring one for the other.
You wrote a book called Citizen Kane, The Big Lies Behind the Big Eyes, about the artist.
Yeah.
I know there was a documentary recently. Were you involved with the documentary as well?
A documentary about Margaret Keane or...
Yes, Walter that Keane documentary. The documentary about the Keens, I forget what it's called, but it came out fairly recently.
I'm not sure, because people interview me and talked about various subjects, and I think one of them I did, but I wasn't explicitly involved in the making of that particular movie or documentary. The thing is that that book came out of, I also wrote feature stories for a newspaper in San Diego called the San Diego Reader, and we did a big, I did a big cover story on the Keens, on Walter Keene and Margaret Keene and their fights and coming out of it and how that whole worked out. And later on, in more recent years, it came out in that Tim Burton movie. The guys who did that, who wrote the script for that, also wrote the script for the Ed Wood movie that, you know, it's on a book that I published called Nightmare of Ecstasy. So I do get involved with things that get worked out in movies. The Keene story is one of them.
Did the artist Trevor Brown do a lot of work? He did the work for your Apocalypse Culture and also a number of other books published by Drill House.
Yeah, he's done some stuff, but not much as you're making it seem, but I like his work a lot. He's a great artist, and, you know, he does strange, weird, juvenile, sexual things that really turn people the wrong way sometimes, where they don't like it so much. The but he's a pretty amazing guy. I think he lives in Japan.
Yes. I became a fan, actually, through reading Answer Me. There was the infamous rape issue where it had Peter Sotos and Trevor Brown's art, and that, and as well as the band White House, too. Trevor Brown's aesthetic image with White House went together, or something of that nature. And yes, it has a very controversial edge to it, though I think there is some fine art to it, and you just have to step back and look at these things. And I do think I'm actually quite excited because Nine Banded Books, Chip Smith's label, is republishing Answer Me and all the four issues in that. And I know you have published also most of Jim Goad's book, and I think it's just interesting because all these controversial artists and writers are actually all coming out of Farrell House.
Well, perhaps, but it's more like you know, talented people who are not that well known, commercially. They know each other. And so I run into people who appreciate the stuff I do, and I appreciate their work. And, you know, you speak to one another. Mm.
And with Peter Sotos, you've published his work. A lot of people just dismiss him as a shock artist, but there is an element of serious social commentary to his work.
Well, people really, you know, it's difficult to bring him up without people saying that he's mad, he's crazy, he should get no attention, and all that stuff. But he's, you know, on a personal level, he's like the nicest guy you could ever hope to meet. And he's a wonderful guy, really. And people kind of shocked to hear that, because of the subject matter of his books and all that stuff and his writing style. But he's a good writer. He knows how to structure a sentence or a paragraph or a story. He's really great at it. And so I've got a lot of respect for him.
Especially in the Ian Brady book with the reissue that he has Bait in there. I think Bait is one of his best works he has recently released. I think that is very condensed and so much is going on in that.
Yeah, well, the Ian Brady story, he knows it better than anybody, I think. Even Colin Wilson.
Yes.
But Colin Wilson is now deceased, so... Mm. He was an interesting guy to work with.
I actually, on the subject of Peter Sotos, you released the book Pure Filth. And I actually got to meet Jamie Gillis very shortly before he passed away. And I had the same impression of him, a very nice guy like Sotos, like what you said about Sotos, that was, you know, very, very well known for being controversial. So I was wondering a lot about that book.
Well, I got involved with that book long before Jamie Gillis died. It was going to be more memoir-like than it actually came out at the end, but we went with what we had at the time. And so Jamie's writing material for the book, or the Farrell House version of the book. And that, but he passed away at that time. So the book is, you know, has various aspects to it. It has the autobiographical aspect to it. It also has the weird idea about the X-rated film industry and all the people who would show up when he would present himself at X-rated bookstores and so on. It's a curious scene, that's for sure.
One thing that's interesting about Peter Sotos is I saw this talk he gave at a bookstore in New York, and you had all these kind of artsy types, but they were very open-minded. I think the whole sort of art scene has been taken over more by political correctness and censorship, but back then you noticed a big change in the culture, seeing all these like artsy people who would be hipsters today listening to Peter Sotos.
I think that was for pure filth, actually. That was recent. And there was also, too,
No, I'm agreeing with you. Pure filth, right.
There's also, too, you edited Cinerama, which is about the pornographic paperbacks of the 60s. That's really cool. There seems to be this theme with Feral House, of as well as It's a Man's World about the men's adventure magazines. It's that love for that
right.
pulp era that existed, you know, in that 50s, 60s, 70s era that you don't see today now because of the internet and everything is, you know, there's no use for the pulp back. But those pulps seem to have some unique underground art to it, you know. Like that, like kind of like in music, you find that record and it's something special no one knows about. And I think there's something cool about the underground arts where it can happen also in the mainstream, especially with the whole Cinerama stuff.
Glad you think so. Yeah, those subjects are not overwhelmed by, you know, books about them, and there are things you can find that are otherwise not noticed or given credit for. And so that intrigued me, that all these things, the modern time aspect of these underground books. Underground because they weren't sold in actual bookstores. They're sold in maybe a couple lower view pharmacies with the revolving racks or things where you just didn't, they're not normally considered like this is a bookstore you go to. So it's in the way people got information and also sexual allure without, you know, looking at a magazine or going to an actual bookstore. It was a provocative time, provocative way.
We recently had this guest on, Robert Brenner, who gives tours of the history of the sex industry in Times Square, mostly from the 60s and 70s. You familiar with him? And I know you published that book on the topic of Times Square by Joshua Allen Friedman, who's a musician.
Yeah, Tales of Times Square, right, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I don't know this particular guy. I'm sorry. I no longer live in New York. I did in the 80s, though.
Times Square.
When I got to know that imbecile named Donald Trump. People had a different perspective of him back then, that's for sure.
Whatchamacallit, Times Square supposedly used to have been a sleazy place, but now when you think about it, it's kind of the center of where everybody in the world is at, you know, this whole economic or entertainment place. And there is this side where it's that sleazy New York scene.
Yeah. That wouldn't be on 42nd Street anymore, but, you know, when I was living in New York in the 80s, it was totally sleazy, extremely so, in every way.
Did you notice that same culture in L.A. and San Francisco as well?
Well, yeah, I mean, but there are portions of each of those towns that are, you know, it was funny because I had an office in downtown Los Angeles in the 90s and the early aughts, and it was on Spring and Sixth Street, and that's, there were a lot of drugs being dealt down there, and a lot of homeless around the area. And it's funny, I had a friend who was a Marine who ran a publishing company, you know, a record company called Amphetamine Reptile. His name is Tom Hazelmeyer. And so he, you know, his friends, he put out a record I did. And so he's in downtown LA. I'm showing him the sights. And he's, like, really nervous. This guy was a Marine, a real tough guy. I couldn't believe it. He said, this is more outrageous than anything I've ever seen in any other city. So that amused me.
I know the area you're talking about, now it's the big, like the trendiest part of downtown Spring Street where they have all the art galleries and stuff.
Yeah, it's turned upscale a bit, yeah.
J.G. Michaels, you want to ask a question?
I was interested in what you were saying earlier about, you know, how Feral House, a lot of the material was about sort of escaping the sort of corporate sphere. You published a lot of books by, like, John Zerzan, the book Secession by Thomas Niller. How did the issue of sort of exiting the or opting out of the system become such an issue for Feral House to explore?
Well, it's just that these books that you've or of ideas and subjects that you find personally interesting, but they're not really covered by other publishers, there are, of course, the you know, anarchist leftist thing, but there are things they don't do, you know, they have conflicts with. And so that intrigues me when it's something that's not considered worthy of publishing by all these supposed outsider publishers or underground publishers.
It seems like the biggest subjects that shock people is like hardcore punk, white nationalism, violence, and other taboo subjects of crime. And it's as if that Feral House, through some of his books, where, you know, you could be learning about black metal or, like, the history of, you know, fascism in America or some mysticism going on or a certain youth subculture that people were not aware of. It certainly takes that tradition of what made Popglitz culture popular, and now that you have a label of different sizes of information or taboo subjects which become, and it seems to me that that's became almost a trademark for Feral House to sell. I don't know.
Well, I don't really think in that matter, mainly. I just if there are things that are underplayed or underdeveloped as a theme elsewhere, and they have interesting material, then of course it's the best thing to publish, because then it's not, there are about 1.5 million different punk rock histories, aren't there? I mean, it's like, so what do you do in that regard? You do about punks that are not really covered by the other books and that theme, you know? So that's what you try to do, things that are less developed or less commercially created.
I also like the work of Joseph P. Farrell. There's that one book, Jeans, yeah. Giants, Monsters, and Men. Some of his stuff is just, wow. I love what he writes about. They're different ways of thinking, and it's kind of considered spiritual, but also science fiction at the same time. It's something that I would really enjoy. And have you met Joseph P. Farrell, and how did they came about publishing his books?
I was introduced to Joseph by, I think it was Richard Holland. He was interested in Hoagland, too. Did that book called Dark Mission with Hoagland about the NASA and what was going on with NASA programs. So I haven't met him personally, just phone conversations and emails. But he's a very private guy. I mean, he's not big on meeting people, you know.
Interesting.
How would you describe your political outlook? You mentioned that you're obviously not a fan of Donald Trump, but I've also heard that you're critical of political correctness and neoliberalism. Would you say that's an accurate description?
Sure. Sure. Yeah. It's like, yeah, I have trouble with some aspects of leftism. I have trouble with a lot of aspects of republicanism because it's just like very, you know, the corporate world is, yeah, it just, you just see where, you know, if you look into it, it, you know, it's a kind of a racket on all sides. And that's unpleasant to deal with.
You have a lot of material that would offend, I think, both the left and the right. Have you had personal issues with censorship? And has it come from all political angles or one particular group if there has been censorship issues?
Well, censorship, generally I haven't run into that. There are books, like we've done, books have been translated into Russia, and they were put down by the state of Russia. Apocalypse Culture, also the book I did, its collection called Extreme Islam, they were not allowed to be sold in Russian language translations. The Canadian government bought this book called Cat, A Handbook for Heels, which was a takeoff in 50s men's magazines. It was too anti-woman to be sold. There were these new laws to pass in the 90s that, you know, made that happen. And, you know, all that surprised me. The book was not particularly vile in any way. But, you know, I was exploring an actual aspect of human society in America. And they took offense at it.
Yeah, I was going to ask about this is a little bit off topic from what we were talking about, but just growing up with your father, Woodrow Parfrey, in Hollywood, and what that experience was like.
Well, I think my folks moved out to L.A., when I was 5 years old. I was born in 1957, and they moved out to L.A. in 1962. I'm like 4 or 5 years old. And when I'm out in L.A. in the early 60s, my dad wouldn't take me to the movie set where he's, you know, doing a TV show or a movie. And that's intriguing. I enjoyed doing that and being there. There's one time, you know, that TV series called Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea? Okay. So there's this one episode which my father plays a bad guy who controls a big giant white ape with a remote control, and he's on the submarine and causing a scene there. And so there was one scene that they're like the two leads of the show, Richard Basehart and David Edison, are on an island and they're exchanging gunfire with somebody. And so I'm there and they're about to film. And then at one point, as they're about to shoot, my stomach started growling loudly. And so sort of interrupted their shooting and filming. And then Basehart yells out, "Who the fuck is that? Shut the fuck up!" I'm like 5 years old, okay? So, you know, I'd run through a scene like that. And most of the time I'd not cause any trouble or any problem, like stomach growling or anything like that. But there, at that time, they were shooting a lot of Westerns in the back set in various studios, Warner Brothers and Burbank area. I go out there. There are these guys who would often be extras or stand-ins for those shows, and they're the same guys always. You see them every time you go on the set like that, and they show you how to, you know, the various how to twirl a gun or toss a rope. Or things like that. But it was interesting. There was this whole world of regulars in that environment who are the guys on every single Western, the extras, the stand-ins. There was that aspect of it.
That was going to lead into another question I had. I know Crispin Glover has worked with you on What Is It? And also the same essay of the same name in Apocalypse Culture.
Yeah. Crispin's a longtime friend of mine. Absolutely.
How did that creative relationship come about? I was just curious.
Well, both of us have a similar upbringing in a way. His father is also a character actor, like my father was. And so he grew up in the industry, sort of like I did, in a not too dissimilar way. And he was producing books, strange books of his. They were sort of like takeoffs from pest eradication textbooks and stuff like that. And so he had, you know, odd alternative point of view on things, and he appreciated the stuff I did, so we had some connection in that way.
Your dad was in the original Dirty Harry. Were you there when that was filmed?
No, I was not there when that was filmed, no. But I think that was filmed on outside a the exteriors, that is, when they're doing a shooting, a gun shooting at a supposed bank area, which that was in a different place than you think, the way it looks in the film. So, yeah, but the guy who directed that, his name is Don Siegel, and Don Siegel did a lot of great films. So he's a family friend. And, you know, we go over to the Siegel's house a lot for holidays and other reasons. He lived in the Sherman Oaks area in a house with a pool and all that stuff. So that was part of my childhood director friend thing.
You wrote a play about a Giles de Ray, the wickedest man in the world, that this was back in 83. Can you talk about that? He was a French aristocrat and a famous serial killer.
Yeah, Guy de Ray. Yeah. I wrote a book about him and his friend, the woman, blocking out the name, but he's known as being a saint, like Joan of Arc.
Mm-hmm.
And they were friends, Guy de Ray and Joan of Arc. And what was that all about? That intrigued me. And then what he was finally arrested for. And, you know, if you're a wealthy man in the world at that point, you are not arrested. You kill a lot of people and not be taken in. That's what happened with him. He was killing for years. But it was he wasn't killing wealthy or known people, so he was getting away with the crime. It was an interesting bit of history for me. And so I wrote about a play about that. And later on, when I was living in San Francisco, I put on a show of it at the On Broadway Theater. You might have heard about a punk club called the Mabuhay. It was the Broadway's above the Mabuhay, the second story of that building.
Are you interested in Aleister Crowley?
Well, of course, he's a fascinating figure, interesting guy, very influential, of course. So, yeah, I early on read his Confessions book and other books in that realm. I don't follow his ideas. I belong to the OTO, but he's a fascinating figure.
There's more of a focus on his involvement in the occultism. Have you studied his philosophical and political ideas?
Yeah, I've read about so-called political ideas. We did a book about him called Secret Agent 666. He was involved with the intelligence industry agencies with the British aristocrats in the war times.
Some time ago, David Cole was interviewed on The Stark Truth, and Feral House also published Republican Party Animal, which was about David Cole, or David Stein, as he known as. He was known for his, you know, Holocaust denial film, and was on, you know, Phil Donahue and all that stuff. And so I think it's funny, because it seems to me that when you're looking at these books, you have one book by David Cole about his life as being that his character becomes interesting. And why did Feral House exactly publish the Republican Party Animal, or did David Cole approach you?
Well, I don't remember exactly how that occurred, but I did a column for the San Diego Reader newspaper one called L.A., where I go around to various events or places in L.A., write about on a weekly column basis. One time I went into one of these TV shows. It was one of these TV shows about go to see the haters talk about nasty things like Holocaust denial. I'm not even sure if it was called that at the time. It was so I saw this TV episode being made. So was that Down guy, or what was his name? So
was it the Phil Donahue show?
Yes.
No, it was another show.
Oh.
That I'm thinking of. But yeah, he had done that show, or was going to do that show, whatever. But there were aspects about his beliefs and what he was saying that they were not all nasty, and it was hard to call a guy who's a bar mitzvah Jew being like hateful anti-Jew, and specifically he was not at that period wasn't politically oriented. He later became oriented later in his life with republicanism. I don't share his interest in that or his belief in that. But it's a lot about wartime propaganda that is, you know, after you're through with war, you realize that's not truth. It's just a way to build up a case against an enemy. There's aspects about the Holocaust itself is part of a wartime propaganda machine. That made sense to me. Didn't make think it's an awful thing to say that if it's more factual than not. So he's an interesting guy. I disagree with him about a number of things, but I thought it was an intriguing book to publish.
Is there any issue that is off limits for Feral House? Any taboos, or are you willing to cover any topic if it works?
Well, not that many, I guess.
Because on the front page, your choices are real politic, culture with a K, music, occult, drugs, crime, sex, death, as if it couldn't get any gets your attention like that. And once again, I feel that the people that really Feral House has attracted have almost created, I would say that Feral House has almost created the whole, maybe like the whole underground book scene or that pulp scene that was once active among young kids in inner cities trying to get these, looking for that book that has that forbidden area of knowledge. And all of a sudden it seems that Feral House is publishing these titles that you want to get the raw grittiness to something of a taboo subject and you want to embrace fully to it. And you want the world to, that's what I get that feeling where it's like Feral House is crossed with that maybe eccentric queer culture and as well as that inner city book culture.
Okay, well, yeah, I guess so. It's, but when you say queer culture, we're not really in that world for much.
Huh.
So, but it's not like we're purposely avoiding it either. So,
Yeah,
just not a theme that run after so much.
You mentioned the book It's a Man's World was censored in Canada. Was one of the main
yes.
factors that it uses the Nazi imagery in the cover?
No. Wait a minute. I think you're thinking of, what is it? It's a Man's World? Is that the one you're discussing?
Yeah, that was the one. The one
I think it wasn't It's a Man's World that was a Confederate book, so-called, but it was the what was it again? The book had a Handbook for Heels, which was a takeoff of 50s men's magazines. You know that book?
Oh yeah, I think I remember the woman you're talking about. Well, there was the one with
that,
the
that's what got trouble in Canada, that book.
I was thinking of the one with the there's a bunch of Nazis and they're tying up a woman and they have her feet like in boiling water.
Well, there was the post-war adventure magazine stuff that was interesting to me because of that. It wasn't even wartime. It was a post-war time. But you thought it was for people who really missed the idea of being that type of male in America to fight these propaganda wars or political wars. And a lot of them had to do with the nasty thing the Nazis do or the Russians, what they do. And so it has to do with a lot of that wartime propaganda machine that people were just missing at the time, years afterward. And that was curious to me.
The book I mentioned earlier about architecture, the one I was thinking of was Pacific Ocean Park, The Rise and Fall of LA Space Age and Nautical Pleasure Pier. I think that's about a specific place at Ocean Park, but I think there's very few of those kind of places left. I think the only one I can think of is the Santa Cruz Boardwalk.
Yeah. Well, the Pacific Ocean Park or POP, my folks took me to that as a child, and then we lived not far up the Pacific Coast Highway from there, so it was a childhood memory for me, and that intrigued me, and I wanted to do a book on that. And there are people, the writers of the book, Christopher Merritt and Dominic Priori, who had researched it as well and put the book together for us. That'd be a great fun. And you don't see those kind of amusement parks anymore on that way, in that level.
And yeah, I know even at Disneyland, they've gotten rid of the original mid-century space age aesthetic at Tomorrowland, and it's really, I haven't been there in like 15 years, but what they built was pretty cheesy, what they replaced it with.
Right. Well, now you can go to Times Square and see it.
Yeah. There's a book published on the French 60s pop culture.
About the Yeah Yeah Girl?
Yeah.
Oh,
the
yeah.
Yeah Yeah Girls book?
That's a good one.
It is. I love music and really appreciated it. And particularly, it's a kind of theme that would seem kind of anti-woman in a way, but it really wasn't at the time. And people are, you know, proud of it in French culture. And so it's interesting perspective to get into about Brigitte Bardot and Francois Hardy and other singers at the time. And as time goes on, you'll find out, I'm just signing a deal now with one of the bigger stars in that realm. And I'm very excited about that. And I can't let you know yet. The contract's not fully signed yet, but it's going to be interesting. But I haven't given up that theme as a for books to be published in the future.
Hilliter, what were you saying earlier about the aesthetic of that? It reminded you of something?
Yeah, well, we have a friend named Rabbit. He has a website called www.altleft.com, and it's also a political ideology, but also an artistic sense where books published, like, you also have the Modern Utopia novel, where it's about these aesthetics, you know, with the Yeah Yeah Girls from the 60s and that whole revolution change, not exactly hippiedom, but certainly Rabbit is in love with that aesthetic, and it reminds me that there's a certain type of person or culture that follows that. I mean, especially thinking about some other things, it reminds me of like Boyd Rice and his album Hatesville, where you have this kind of, you know, this beatnik art on it, and it's kind of this aesthetic that's kind of more edgier, but it just reminds me there's certainly this flirtation with the this mod girl aesthetic, and it reminds us.
Yeah, Boyd was really into that. So was Don Bowles, and I learned about these things from both of them, and in the past before I even started to do that book. Also, I went to Montreal, Canada once, and finding French record stores that would have the singles and the EPs and the LPs of those themes. And I just love that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, since you mentioned Boyd Rice, one thing I almost forgot to ask about was the Abraxas Foundation, because that seems to tie into the whole... the interest in Nazi aesthetics or wartime aesthetics, I should say, and also the occult. Could you talk about that?
It has more to do, I think, with Charles Manson.
Yeah, the 88 rally. Yeah.
Back in the 80s, I did a book called The Manson File, because all Manson books at the time, particularly then, including up to today, were about how horrible this murderer is and this cult thing, and let's find out ways we can strike down the youth culture because of it. And so, you know, Manson was like a political theme. It was Richard Nixon saying on television, even before the trial, that Charles Manson is guilty of this and that. It's like he was already guilty even before a trial or before evidence of the crimes came about. And what was that about? So you have to explore whole societal damage created by supposedly created by Charles Manson. What was that? It was what that was, and some of it was bullshit. So it's true, and you know, I'm a fan of the people, some of the people that were murdered in those events. I'm, you know, Sharon Tate. I mean, what a great woman, and hate that she's murdered and all that stuff. But the whole Manson theme was a way to, you know, level aim, a societal aim at hippies and youth culture at the time.
Were you influenced by Mae Brussell at all? I know you released The Essential Mae Brussell, but she talked about Manson a bit too.
Yeah, she did. She spoke of Manson. Because, you know, it was interesting that Mae Brussell came from a family. They were pretty wealthy, and they owned a department store in Westwood area. It's right near UCLA and so on. So, well, she's a privileged woman. And that's, it's interesting that she did this conspiratorial liberal investigations. Really fascinating that she, what she got into and why she got into them. And she's totally off the beaten track, and that intrigued me. And so she's, you know, not appreciated as much as she should be.
Are you still a musician, or would you ever consider going back to music?
Well, as a child, I played the oboe in the high school orchestra and stuff like that. And then I played a tenor saxophone half a year when you couldn't get out of PE class otherwise. So I did that, played the tenor saxophone because it was like marching band thing. See, I don't play music. I don't play an instrument. Mm. If I do any music, it's a vocalist mainly. And I don't do that very frequently. Mm. I'm not opposed to it.
You collaborated with the band Poison Idea. Could you like go over that real quick at all?
Yeah, you know the band? They do kind of a hardcore punk thing. They're good musicians. They do good recordings, and they're talented at what they do. And I'm friends with them, particularly when I lived in Portland area. I no longer do, but did at one point, and they were very helpful for recordings that I was doing, playing in them, and help with the producing them as well. So it comes from a respect for their ability and for being friends and their ability to understand the offbeat ideas I had, too.
What do you see as the cultural impact that Feral House has on the culture in general, but also on an individual level?
Well, you're going to have to ask other people about that, because I don't know how people interpret or what they get out of it. A lot of people say that it really changed their lives or influenced their lives, and that's a lovely thing to hear, that you had some people exploring a wider array of things than they ordinarily do, but that's fine. But I guess that's the main thing, I guess, is just sharing interests with people.
Now that you have the 4chan or websites like Encyclopedia Dramatica, people can find other stuff on the internet, or at least areas of knowledge similar to Feral House with the use of a computer. But I think Feral House does something started out first with publications before there ever was an internet, actually.
That's true, yeah. But it, you know, That's all well and good. It's sort of like it's a time when people are less interested in buying books or pursuing books. So much to look at online and get it for free. Why would they be interested in going out and purchasing a book and keeping us in business? Well, I may not be publishing books anymore if it keeps going in that direction. So if people want us to continue, they should really look into the Fairhouse books and purchase them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we can carry on with our business.
We're both working on novels. I guess both of our novels would be fairly controversial.
Yeah, so not to, again, with the whole shock art, depending how, what you consider shock art or forbidden areas of knowledge, but certainly going over Stark's book, it definitely has everything as an influence from Feral House in there, and I think it would be suitable for maybe a possible Feral House release.
Well, we don't really publish fiction, though.
No, it's interesting.
Oh, so it's exclusively nonfiction. Why did you make that decision? Did you ever consider fiction at one point?
Sure, of course we did. You think of the realm of what's available and what are you going to focus on? What are you going to do? And I thought that when I started the business or the publishing company that you can find a certain type of nonfiction book, but there's others you cannot. And so I thought that was a wider realm to investigate or to be part of.
There's also Nine Banded books, which they focus on fiction, but there is some overlap in the themes. Are you familiar with that?
I know the guy who runs that, yeah.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Adam Parfrey for being on. It's been an excellent show. We've covered a lot of really fascinating topics.
All right, guys. Well, good to speak with you, and carry on well.
Nice talking to you.
Thank you, Adam.
Nice talking to you.
All right. Yes, likewise. Take care.